Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Valerie Clark Miller seemed to have it all. Smart and beautiful, with a wealthy, successful husband and growing family, Valerie appeared to be the picture-perfect Mormon wife, but it was all a facade. Inside, she was crumbling from the pressures of long-repressed memories of a childhood filled with sexual and physical abuse. In the new book, Hometown Betrayal, author Emily Benedict takes you behind the closed doors of the remote Mormon community of Clarkston, Utah. With the help of hundreds of individual stories, she pieces together not only what happened to Valerie, but also the conditions and culture that allowed it. Hometown Betrayal culminates in an account of the Miller family's fight to hold accountable the man, including the local cop, who abused Valerie and controlled the system designed to look the other way. We'll be talking with Emily Benedict about Hometown Betrayal following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Valerie Clark Miller seemed to have it all. Smart and beautiful, with a wealthy, successful husband and growing family, Valerie appeared to be the picture-perfect Mormon wife, but it was all a facade. Inside, she was crumbling from the pressures of long-repressed memories of a childhood filled with sexual and physical abuse. In the new book, Hometown Betrayal, author Emily Benedict takes you behind the closed doors of the remote Mormon community of Clarkston, Utah. With the help of hundreds of individual stories, she pieces together not only what happened to Valerie, but also the conditions and culture that allowed it. Hometown Betrayal culminates in an account of the Miller family's fight to hold accountable the man, including the local cop, who abused Valerie and controlled the systems designed to look the other way. Emily Benedict grew up in Belmont, Massachusetts, graduated from Harvard College. Her stories and essays have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Glamour, Vogue, and Dallas Morning News, and on NPR, among others. She's author of three nonfiction books previously: The Wind Won't Know Me, A History of Navajo-Hopi Land Dispute, Beyond the Four Corners of the World, A Navajo Woman's Journey, and Through the Unknown Remembered Gate, A Spiritual Journey. Also author of two thrillers, A Red Sea and Iranian Rhapsody. She lives in New York. Emily Benedict, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you. I know that John, they did a press conference earlier in the year, and John Miller, the husband of Valerie Clark Miller, said that when they came time to commission a book, they wanted somebody from outside the culture. I don't know what exposure had you had to Utah and Latter-day Saint culture before this book?
Interesting question. I grew up in Belmont, as you said, and Belmont actually has quite a large Mormon community. Now there's a large temple there that Mitt Romney built. It was not there when I was growing up, but kids are sort of oblivious to most things that go around them, but the smart kids in the class were often the Mormon kids, and they had large families, and that's all that I knew about Mormons. I had a friend named Brick Bushman who went to high school with me in Belmont and also went to college with me at Harvard, and I only found out after starting this book for John that his father, Richard Bushman, is one of the most renowned historians of the church, LDS Church and Mormons. So that was sort of interesting.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, Richard Bushman, a big name. Yeah,
exactly. And prior to that, the only exposure I had was I wrote a couple books about Navajo and Hopi Indians. And you can't look far into the history of the Indians without, you know, seeing that Mormon missionaries were active on the reservations.
So I think you had access to a lot of materials here, journals. You did a bunch of interviews. Tell me a little bit about the research you did.
Well, I have to make a shout out here to the great gift of diary keeping, which is now seems to be a lost art. But John Miller, bless his heart, when he went on his mission, began to keep a diary, a journal of his thoughts and his activities, and he kept that up through most of his life. And I have to say, if it weren't for that, if there weren't a contemporaneous record that he'd written out in the past when things happened, there's no way this book could have been written. There's no way they could have brought any action against the state of Utah. And there's no way that the family could have addressed what happened to Valerie and got any justice for it. So just something to think about how we create history every day with letters, records or not. But yes, I had access to his journals. And also I had access to Valerie's medical records from the Menninger Clinic, which was extremely important. And I was able to speak to her old doctor there, who's still alive, and was able to help me understand the very detailed records that he'd kept.
So you start the book with one of those key hinge points in Valerie Clark Miller's life, which wasn't involving her directly. It was her daughter, right, who was involved in a serious accident. Tell me a little bit about that.
So they lived in Hiram, little town, Cache Valley. John and Valerie went out for a little drive. John had just gotten a new car, a beautiful spring day, wanted to take her for a spin. And they left their little daughter, Annie, in the care of a neighbor. Innocent day playing with her best friend. But unknown to them, the little girls had gone out for a bike ride. And little Annie was not so steady on her bike, and she had rules that she was not supposed to leave the street in front of their house. But anyway, they came back from their spin, they came home, went inside, and their son Ryan, who was playing Walking on a Wall, remembers, I have this, this is how this book begins, remembers his dad running out of, his mom running out of the house, screaming that Annie's been in an accident. And the father, who had been out listening, speaking to a neighbor, jumped, the both of them jumped in the car and drove into the middle of town, and then found their little daughter just in a lump, like a little bird, he described it, in the street. They pieced together what had happened, but she had crossed the street successfully and then for some reason turned quickly and gone, headed back into traffic and been hit by a truck and thrown into the air, a big arc, and landed on her head. So this was the emergency, this was the crisis that precipitated Valerie's sinking into a depression, probably sympathizing intensely with the child and the injury to her head. The child was in the hospital for about 6 months in a coma, and they didn't know if she would survive. Actually, all odds were against her surviving, but Valerie sort of impressed and frightened her family at the same time, but with the power of her faith, she just prayed and prayed and prayed, as if the only distance between her daughter's survival and not was the strength of her own prayer. And she really knocked herself out. This was the precipitating fact of a deep depression, and then the release of memories of the past, her past.
Yeah, and this is, I don't think this is atypical, right? This can be, suppressed for a long time, and then something like this can bring it to the surface.
Right, I think, yes, exactly. Of all kinds of things in our lives, right? You just have a memory that passes and it all of a sudden opens up a pathway to more memories. But yes, there, it was really not understood at the time in the 80s and 90s when she was experiencing these series of flashbacks and fearful moments and great anxiety and so forth. But now we know a little bit more about something called PTSD and the changes that can happen to the brain of someone who's suffered great trauma, and the psychological systems that we put in place to protect ourselves on a daily basis from the memories, but then cause their own problems. As they say, when memories are buried, it's like the memory is put away, out of mind, out of sight, but it's buried, it's attached to all these emotions. And as they say, they're buried alive in the body, and buried alive implies activity and movement, and those that the emotion and the memories have the tendency to want to come to the surface.
Before we go back to the young Valerie Clark and what happened, I had not put this together until I was reading your book. I'd been somewhat aware of this case. John Miller is a famous name in Cache Valley and in Utah. E.A. Miller Company and Meatpacking Plant. So Valerie Clark Miller, as we said in the opening blurb there, seemed to have it all. Smart, beautiful, wealthy, successful husband, growing family, embedded in the culture. But she had this buried alive, as you say.
She had these memories buried alive, correct, and conflicts. I mean, you know, in retrospect, after this all happened, John remembers, you know, when thinking about it, little signs, a mysteriousness about her. He describes a scene when he was dating her and at her parents' house, of sitting with her in the backyard and watching her, looking at her face when she was sort of gazing off into the distance. And he thought, you know, she's so beautiful. And part of her beauty is this mystery. But he also wondered to himself, like, is there something, you know, what is behind this mystery? Is there something I don't know? Or, you know, also, you know, she was a little distracted. Sometimes she couldn't, you know, sometimes she would get distracted while in the midst of a task. So the memories, the overt memories were buried, but she was very preoccupied. I think she used a lot of her mental energy keeping the memories at bay and the emotions that went with them. So, you know, it's not a costless, it's not an enterprise without cost in the daily life to keep these memories repressed. But, you know, she was busy.
Yeah.
Busy with children.
Mm-hmm. Had four children, I think, right?
Had four children, yes.
Yeah.
Quick succession.
In quick succession, yeah, yeah. Married this, bright, successful man, and apparently had a good life. And, you know, in many ways did, but a lot of this energy was going to deal with this trauma. Well, let's take a brief break. When we come back, I want to have you take listeners back to 1968 when these horrible things happened to young Valerie Clark. We're talking about the book Hometown Betrayal, and the author is Emily Benedict. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Valerie Clark Miller seemed to have it all, smart and beautiful, with a wealthy and successful husband, growing family. She appeared to be the picture-perfect Mormon wife, but it was all a facade. Inside, she was crumbling from the pressures of long-repressed memories of a childhood filled with sexual and physical abuse. Author Emily Benedict is with us. She tells the story in Hometown Betrayal, a new book that's out and available. Riveting read. 1975 is when Valerie Clark married John Miller. By 1984, they had four children together. I think it was the late 1980s when this accident happened and these memories came spilling out. So 1954 was when Valerie Clark was born. So when she was 14, I guess, 1968 is when these horrible events happened. Before we recount those briefly, Emily Benedict, tell me a little bit, what have you been able to piece together about the young Valerie Clark? What kind of girl was she? And tell us a little bit about this community.
Oh, Valerie was the most beautiful girl in town. She was very sweet, very understanding. Everyone in town seemed to have a story about her and how sweet she was. She was also smart, very good in school, active. You know, she was in the Vistons, which was the like the drum majorettes kind of thing, the dance troupe, the dance group that performed in football games. She was active in student government. She was a great athlete as well. She was a sprinter, and this is in the days when I don't think there was a high school track team, but she went out to AAU events enough to catch the attention of coaches at colleges, and she got a four-year track scholarship to USU. She ran the 100-yard dash and the 220. This is the basis of why I identified with her so deeply. Actually, I was a high school athlete, and also she had a horse named Leo, who was her best friend and in whom she confided in the way that a little girl will confide with her horse. And she would ride around the foothills of the her mountain, as she called it, and tried to sort out the conflicted and competing thoughts in her mind. So she said she had a happy life, but it wasn't really a happy life. There were terrible things that were happening to her. It turns out from the age of four that she just kept inside herself, and she tried to she her she. He, she, it hurt her sense of self and self-esteem, and she overperformed in school to try to compensate. She did try in her own way to alert people around her as to what was happening, but no one seemed to pick up the hints. And it just reinforced in her own mind that she was at fault, that it was something that she must have done. So, you know, I thought a lot when I went out to Utah, and I drove through the area, and I thought about her riding her horse around, and I felt so strongly for her, this girl who trying to sort out and make sense of what had happened to her without any help from the adults around her. And it was horrible.
So this started even earlier than I'd realized. This abuse. Yeah.
Yes. So the first memory that she recalled, first, she had these intrusive thoughts. She would send her husband down at the basement and ask him to look for a Labrador. She said, "I think there's a dog in the house. There's a lab. There's a big, not a Labrador. The German dogs. Sorry, I'm blocking on the name of it.
German Shepherd.
No.
Rottweiler.
Not a Rottweiler, but the other one, the tall, skinny one. Anyway, she had this. She thought that there was one of these dogs in the house, and it turned out that her assailant, Bob Daly, used to drive around town in his pickup truck with one of those dogs in the back, growling at people. So that was the first indication that of the fears that were inside of her. Then, you know, it was so against everything that she'd learned in her whole life to say anything bad about anybody, or to speak badly about men in power over her, or to admit to this horrible thing that had happened to her, and that, you know, in fact, sullied her in the minds of some. But finally, after she broke down and was sort of at wit's end, she had a memory as a 13-year-old. It was right before she turned 14. Her birthday's October 15, so it was like late summer of 1968. She was 13, about to turn 14. Her cousin, her father's cousin, who lived across the street, who was 30 years older than she was, asked her to come, said there were some kittens in the loft of the barn and would she like to see them, and his daughter was going to come around and join her. So she went up to the loft innocently, and the cousin, Gary Thompson, joined her there, and Bob Daly, the local cop, who's now a highway patrolman. And Daly took out a knife and told her to take her clothes off. And she protested, and they put the knife up against her vagina and said, if you say anything or make any noise, I'll put this right into you. And they raped her, each one after the other. And she smelled something funny about them. She figured later that they'd been drinking alcohol, and they left her to put herself back together and walk across the street to her home. They did this in a barn across the street from her house in Clarkston. And that was the first assault. But then as time went on, and after she got treatment, she recalled that the abuse from the father's cousin, Gary Thompson, had begun when she was 4 years old, and it even involved his father. It was not as violent as in the barn, but it was, you know, they were touching her and making clear to her that she belonged to them, and her purpose in life was to provide pleasure for them. And that he had access to her during family camping trips.
Yeah, just horrible, horrible thing. I think no one ever knew. A young child or a girl like that is going to be very reluctant to tell anybody.
She tried. She left as a young girl, sometime between 4 and 9 or 10, she left out some bloody underpants for her mother on the top of the laundry, and she was trying to signal her, but her mother did not notice, or if she noticed, did not say anything. There were other signs too that only became apparent later when John and Valerie went to see her parents after it had all come flooding out. John, this was the last thing Valerie wanted her parents to know. She would rather have chewed off her arm than tell her parents about this. She was so angry, she cried in the car all the way up. But John was determined to tell them because he wanted to pursue some justice for the family or for her. And he said Valerie had been molested. And Valerie did not want him to say who it was. She the only reason she agreed to go up there was if John agreed not to use any names. So John told her father that she'd been molested. And then the father immediately said, I'll bet I know who did that. It was that Gary Thompson and Bob Daly. And John was thunderstruck. Where did that come from? How did he know? And he said, they used to speak very inappropriately about my daughter, right to my face. They used to say, that Valerie, ain't she something? Ain't she something? He said, they used to speak about my daughter as if they knew her more than I did. Now, this came out immediately from him, which means it had taken place over a long period of time. But he didn't believe that evil existed in the town. He could only see and only saw the good. So there were signs. There were signs. And imagine the frustration of this little girl doing whatever she could think of, you know, to save herself and alert people. And no one was responding. In fact, the only way the rapes continued for, we think, a couple of years. She only stopped them by telling Dahlia that she was pregnant. She lied and said that she was pregnant. Imagine her trying to figure out, what can I do? How can I stop this? Because Dahlia, the rapes continued, and they were associated with beatings. They would beat her and tell her, if you tell anybody, we're going to do this to your sister. And then they said, if you tell anybody, we're going to do this to your brother. So she was completely tied up in knots. So imagine how much energy she had to use to try to think about how she could get out of this before getting pregnant, for goodness sakes. So she finally told him that she was pregnant, and he tried to kill her. It was at Newton Reservoir, near the Newton Dam. And she agreed to meet him there. And he said, well, I'll marry you. And she said, well, what? He was married already with a handful of children. And she said, why would I marry you? You're a monster. And then he punched her, knocked her out, and threw her in the water, presumably expecting her to drown. And she was a very good athlete. And she went underwater. It was dark. It was freezing cold. It was like November. And she tried to just swim away from him and get away from him and stay as much as she could under the water and pop up for a breath when she needed it. And he got a flashlight from his truck and sort of kept looking for her, but she stayed out of sight. And after 15 or 20 minutes, when he assumed, I guess, that she was dead, he left. She had ridden to the Newton Reservoir on her horse. And when she was able, she couldn't, it was, there, apparently there was no moon, it was black. She didn't know which direction to swim to get to the source. So she whistled for her horse, and the horse responded to this whistle and neighed. And so she could navigate herself back to the shore and pulled herself up and rode home. Can you imagine? At a 16-year-old girl suffering this. And then he left her alone, finally, stopped.
Yeah, that's just so tragic. So the abuse finally stops. No one knows, right? And as you said earlier, how much energy is required to put your life together and try to live a quote unquote normal life? I guess that's what she tried to do going forward.
Yeah, she. Well, you know, no one knew, right? We say that, no one knew. But then the investigation that followed. So John, in 2020, John's son Ryan had read a book, Mindhunters, about an FBI attempt in the 80s to interview serial killers and try to come up with a profile. Who are the kind of people who did this? He said, and he said to his dad, why don't we finally find out what happened to mom. She had died in 2017, complications from MS, on top of everything else, all the anxiety, all the tension. So what's the cost of keeping secrets like this inside and trying to keep yourself going? You can get autoimmune diseases. You can get psychiatric illnesses. She got both. And she eventually became crippled from this runner, this wonderful athlete became crippled and had to make use of a wheelchair to get around. Making it more difficult for her to find ways to relieve herself, because exercise and walking and running was always a relief for her. John said, all right, we will. And he assembled a team. He hired a retired FBI agent with great experience in Utah and with polygraphs, and a couple of former federal prosecutors, one of whom had prosecuted the case against Elizabeth Smart's kidnapper and abuser. And so began an investigation that led eventually to the family but indicating to the state that they were prepared to sue. So, what is the damage of keeping those kind of secrets inside and trying to live a life? She died from complications from MS, and she struggled with abuse of prescription drugs that the doctors gave her. Not only that, it turns out that Utah was chosen by the drug manufacturers as a good place to introduce some of the most dangerous opiates, because they didn't want to be accused of putting drugs into areas that of potential drug dealers. So they said, we're going to find communities of rural white people who aren't fit the profile of drug users. And so Utah is one of the central ground zero of opiate addiction at the beginning. And Valerie was victim to it. She just was looking for a peace. She wanted to go up into the clouds, was her expression. I used the drugs to go into the clouds, away from it all. And in fact, when she was being assaulted by the men, she said, she described what the dissociation felt like. She said, I felt that I was in the lap of Heavenly Father, and he would protect me from being killed or really badly injured. And so that was the place she went, into the clouds.
Mm. So tell me a little bit about, I think it's 1989, her daughter has this accident. She goes into a depression. These memories start to surface. Tell me about that treatment, what the family tried to do at that point.
Well, she had four children. Well, and she had three children, and then she got pregnant with a fourth child in the midst of her breakdown. And John had a very active life, and he, an ambitious person. They moved to Omaha. He was put in charge of a big meatpacking plant there, and he was an executive, and she had some duties of executive wives. So there really wasn't much time for her to deal with her problems. She had to keep putting one foot in front of the other. Finally, she couldn't. It was obvious she was just falling to pieces. She was anorexic. She was taking drugs. She wasn't able to keep up. There were a couple of frightening experiences. She would lose control of herself, and she would scream at the children sometimes and throw things. And this frightened John, it frightened the children. And finally, a psychologist recommended to him, maybe, you know, the Menninger Clinic is sort of the place of last resort. Maybe you should try it. And, you know, everyone in the family, of course, was suffering from their mother's trauma or wife's trauma. Everyone was affected. And John was too. So, he decided that Valerie should go, and they discussed it, and she concurred. And for the first time in her life, she was an inpatient, so she didn't have to take care of, she wasn't preoccupied and occupied all of her waking hours with taking care of other people. She could start thinking about herself. And she had a very, very sympathetic doctor who tried to have, you know, no ambition for her or himself, except to allow her to begin to talk about herself and her life and who she was. She had really constructed kind of a fake self in order to survive. And, the instruction that she got at school and at church about sexuality was was limited and actually, strangely enough, put a great deal of responsibility on the girl herself for managing her sexual life. There was a famous writer named Helen Andelin, whose work was very popular at the time, who I write about in the book, who gave very conflicting advice to young girls, advice that really couldn't possibly be followed. One, if you should, God forbid, get pregnant out of wedlock, you ruined your life. You're responsible for what a boy does to you or a man does to you, or you're responsible for controlling his sexuality, if whether or not he wants too much or too little. It was extremely confusing. So, and her father is a sweet, sweet guy. He was bishop. He was mayor. He just wanted what was best for everybody. But he was a real old timer, and he would tell stories about kind of ghosts mystical kind of things. And Valerie, it was also the 60s, the 70s, the idea of the self, the idea of autonomy, the idea of agency was not even on, wasn't even in the vocabulary. So she really didn't have the tools to understand what was happening to her and to defend herself from the crimes being committed against her. So she had to put herself all back together again. And it was inhibited by her desire to get back into the clouds where she didn't have to think about it. It was just, overwhelmingly shameful for her.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the tragic life of Valerie Clark Miller. And the book is Hometown Betrayal. The author is Emily Benedict, who's with us. Let's take another brief break. We'll come back. Much more to talk about here. Following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with author Emily Benedict. The latest book is Hometown Betrayal. We're talking about Valerie Clark Miller, who lived in here in Cache Valley, where I'm broadcasting to you from. Emily Benedict, part of this is so tragic is cover up and mishandled investigations, and the truth really not being coming out and being acknowledged until the years and decades later. In fact, after Valerie Miller's death. So there was an investigation in 1990. So 1989, Valerie Clark Miller. This accident of her, with her daughter, things began to come out. Utah Department of Public Safety did an investigation. The one of the men who abused Valerie Clark was by that time, I think, a UHP lieutenant. Tell me a little bit about that investigation, which the department now acknowledges was mishandled.
Well, it actually wasn't an investigation at all.
Okay.
When Valerie recovered enough that she could tell her story to people, it took a long time for her to, get the words out of her mouth. It was, what she was telling was beyond her ability, one, to comprehend and then to acknowledge and tell the world what had happened to her. There was such shame attached to it, but Valerie, John wanted justice, and he brought Valerie to the authorities to tell her story. And the first person that they met with was Mitch Ingersoll, who was responsible for internal affairs. She gave her story. Mitch Ingersoll was very moved by it, and he said that he would conduct an investigation. The next thing that John heard was that he was going to go to Kansas, where the Menninger Clinic then was located, and that he was on his way there. And then he heard soon after that that Bob Daly had taken a lie detector test and passed with flying colors. And if he wanted the investigation to proceed, then Valerie would have to take a lie detector test herself. Now, there's lots of research that shows that someone who is traumatized is not a good candidate for a polygraph test, because polygraph test measures arousal. Any discussion of this event or anything surrounding it was likely, inevitably, would cause her great distress and anxiety. And they didn't think that they could get a legitimate result. So they said no. And also just to protect her, because she was starting to fall apart again. So they let it go. The word coming back to Valerie that he'd passed a lie detector test was devastating. It was another blow to her. And then the two criminals, Gary Thompson and Bob Daly, went around town saying, oh, she's crazy. She's telling stories. She's crazy. And we passed our lie detector tests. So imagine that on top of everything that had happened before then, you know, the power of the badge, the power of the older man. It was just one more blow to her. So then in 2021, when John put together a team, he hired an FBI agent who was a genius, brilliant in the way that he approached the investigation. He very carefully thought who he would go and meet first. And he was interested in command structure, who reported to whom, who was responsible for whom, and who was friends with whom. And he also understood polygraphs. He was an expert for 10 years with the FBI. So he went first to Mitch Ingersoll, the one we just spoke about. And he said, hello, I've been hired by this law firm, and I just wanted to talk about this old assault. He remembered very clearly. Oh, yeah, I remember her. Yeah, yeah. She was crazy. Yeah, I never went to Kansas. I just called on the phone and I talked to her psychiatrist and he said she was crazy. He said that she was schizoid and no one believed her. Schizo, and no one believed her story. So, and oh, by the way, I don't think Daly ever did take a polygraph. I think what was that he was saying, oh, if I have to take a polygraph, let her take one first. I think that's what happened. So in other words, the first person that Mike Anderson met said the opposite of what he'd said 30 years prior. So Anderson then tracked down the doctor at the Menninger Clinic, which had then moved. And he said, I never spoke to anybody. No one ever called me and asked me about her. And I never would have said she was a schizo, because I don't think she was. Schizo meaning schizophrenic. I believed her. So the pieces started pulling together. Then he went to Dwayne Richens, who was the head of the Highway Patrol at the time, and asked him if he recalled that Bob Daly had been investigated for a crime of sexual assault against a child. He said, I don't know. I don't remember anything about it. I should have, because he was one of my employees. And then Anderson went to Bedrero. Bedrero was in the sheriff's department, had come up through the ranks with Daly, and Mike suspected was sort of central to the fact that this investigation went nowhere. And when he walked into Bedrero's house, he again arrived without announcement, but it was clear to him immediately that Bedrero knew why he was there. Although he didn't call in advance, he suspected that Mitch Ingersoll had alerted him to what was coming. And his body language told him he's twisted into a pretzel in his chair. He denied knowing who was head of the Highway Patrol at the time, Dwayne Richens, which was impossible for him not to remember. And Bedrero said that, sorry, I've lost my train of thought here for a second. He denied knowing Bob Daly, but he made a slip. He made a slip early in the interview. Mike Anderson did not tell him the purpose of his visit. He sat down. He asked him if he could tape him, and Bedrero said yes. Why would you, former law enforcement, agree to being taped if you didn't? He didn't know what the purpose of it was. And then Mike made reference to a family in Logan, and Bedrero slipped by saying, yes, she had a lot of family up there, indicating that he already knew the purpose, the subject of Anderson's questioning, which was Valerie Clark. Later on, they were suspicious. The whole interview made Anderson very suspicious. And he finally, the last person he interviewed was Daly himself, who was quite disturbed when Anderson knocked on his door and just denied everything. and then went to his office and riffled around in some papers, as if he were trying to find, and he said he was looking for the results of his lie detector test. But he was shuffling through papers. I can't seem to find the lie detector test. And Mike Anderson said, if I had a statement from a polygrapher that I passed this lie detector test on this very serious crime, I would have it framed and hanging above my, prominently in my house. He couldn't come up with it. He couldn't find the papers, but he did produce another letter. And it was a letter from the state Department of Public Safety telling him that the investigation was over and he'd been found not guilty, that he was that there was no case against him. And he handed that to Anderson, and Anderson didn't know what he had. But when he brought it home, he was astounded because in the letter, there was no CC, the letter to Daly telling him that there was no finding of guilt. There was no CC of his direct boss at the highway patrol. This was from Mitch Ingersoll, but there was a CC to his boss, Bedrero. So Anderson saw there was a conspiracy between Bedrero, who'd come up through the law enforcement system with Daly, was friends with Daly, drove around with him in Clarkston, and Ingersoll to not conduct the investigation, to kill it, and to send a notice to Daly that he was good to go without even notifying his boss that there had been an investigation to start with. So once they had that information, they realized then it was time for them to plan their legal approach, how they were going to approach Department of Public Safety and how they're going to try to prove their case.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I want to just have about.
I'm sorry. I want to interrupt you for one second. There was one more little piece.
Yeah.
Daly said that he took a lie detector, and Gary Thompson's daughter said he took three lie detectors. I've seen them. There were three lie detector tests, and Anderson said, you know, if you have to take two lie detector tests, I'd question, you know, how good the polygrapher is. Three, he doesn't know what he's doing. You know, no one takes three lie detector tests. Why would that even happen? And anyway, he got Daly to say that Daly said he took a lie detector test, and it was the sheriff's office, the person who did it for the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. And Mike Anderson knew that was a man named Steve Bartlett. So Steve Bartlett had passed away in 2017, but he went to visit Steve Bartlett's widow, who had kept his office and all of his records completely as he'd left them. So Mike Anderson was able to go through Steve Bartlett's logbook, and he found that there was no polygraph done of a Gary Thompson or of a Bob Daly. So they were just lying through their teeth.
I just have about a minute or two left in the conversation. I know that Valerie Miller's daughter, Brooke, has said that one of the things that she hopes this book and investigation will have done is to clear her mother's name, restore her reputation. What do you see as the legacy here, the takeaway from this investigation, this book, and filling in the gaps in the story?
Well, John is very interested in the effects of this kind of a trauma on the family. So he's created a nonprofit in which he's trying to reduce the effect of generational trauma on families who have gone through this. Everyone has their own, every member of the family is hurt in his or her own way and has his or her own hopes. But yes, they would like to leave a legacy in their mother's name. In terms of clearing her name, I think it's absolutely cleared, and it's abominable that the men who made her suffer so grievously throughout her life and made her family suffer so grievously should have not only defended themselves by lying, but also turning the tables and calling her crazy. So, but this was a belief in her town of Clarkston. Oh, she was crazy. So it was very important for the father. It's very important for Denzel Clark to feel that his daughter's name's been cleared. I'm interested in something a guest on your show said to you last week, Amos Giora, who is a professor at the Utah State Law School, who's, as you know, he's interested in enablers, people in the community who know of people. His book is about child sexual abuse in schools and how there are people in authority who know what's going on but don't say anything. And what legally can be done, you know, for that? That's a very interesting line of the law. My interest is how can child sexual abuse, the incidence of it be reduced? You know, how can you stop this before it happens rather than having to deal with the consequences? That's where my interest is, and I'm sure that's of interest to the family as well. But I think that the town of Clarkston needs to take a good look at itself and find out what it did and what it's still doing to encourage this kind of behavior. Because there are still members, judging from the comments on the book and on Amazon and so forth, there are still people in town who are denying that any of this happened.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for time. Much more to talk about. Of course, pick up the book, read it. Hometown Betrayal is the book. And we've been talking with the author, Emily Benedict. I'll just mention, you mentioned this, the family has set up a website, generationall.org, dealing with the legacy of trauma, generational trauma from abuse. Emily Benedict, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll go out with, as we usually do on Thursdays, with Leo T. and Skywatcher. Thanks, everybody.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. here. And in the west, after the rains, yes, it's still around. Fading comet Tsushinshan, Atlas poses high in the sky for its fans that have binoculars and telescopes. As we wave farewell for around 100,000 years, the position of the receding comet shows near the end of dusk for skywatchers, and you can check it out on Stellarium Web for exact location. But if you look out to the dusk out in the west, if you're in this area, you look out toward the Great Salt Lake and you'll see Vega. That is going to be on the north end of things, up above the horizon, shining as it always does, beautifully and white. And then near the horizon and a little further to the south will be Venus. And in between this, you can see the comet if you're lucky. Check it out on Stellarium Web for your exact location. And a whole lot of other gems to gaze upon after the old sundown when it's dark. Altair the Eagle is the brightest star high in the southwest with an outrigger to the upper right and at a slight angle and another just to the lower left. It's kind of like one of those Polynesian sailing boats coming across the Pacific Ocean. It's floating in the Milky Way with Delphinus the Dolphin and smaller, fainter Sagitta the Arrow to its lower left. If you're in the mountains or out in the salt flats or in western Nebraska hill country, in other words, anywhere in the dark, you're flirting with the Milky Way. Binos help in the city. Altair looks so bright because it's one of our actually nearest neighbors, just 17 light years away. And thanks to NASA and JPL for this little part of the report and the wealth of things they talk about. On October 29, 1991, the amazing Galileo probe not only reached Jupiter and studied the gas giant and its moons previous to this, but it also went out and visited 951 Gaspra asteroid, and that was in 1991. The Galileo probe had been traveling into the edge of the asteroid belt for a couple of months and came to Gaspra somewhat serendipitously. The asteroid is 12 miles by 7. The probe took photos, kicked the tires with its infrared mapping instrument, and mapped its chemical composition and geography while traveling 5 miles per second, 990 miles from this asteroid. This was the first visit by a spaceship to an asteroid from Earth, at least this time around. Way to go, NASA and JPL. The probe, named after Galileo de Vincenzo Buonaiuti Galilei, who lived 1564 to 1642, commonly called Galileo Galilei or just Galileo. You've heard of him, probably. He was an Italian astronomer, physicist, and engineer, sometimes described as a polymath. That's right, poly, multiple math. He was born in the city of Pisa, then under the part of Duchy of Florence in present-day Italy. Galileo has been called the father of observational astronomy, modern-era classical physics, the scientific method, and modern science, and we now honor him by naming spaceships after him. And as we go back to last week's episode, still playing on the podcast, we talked about a huge black hole filament that wings out for 23 million light years and has the name Porphyrion. And it's a little bit spooky tale for Dia de la Muerta and Halloween. Porphyrion is a prominent role in Greek mythology known as the King of the Giants. He played a crucial role in a fierce war between giants and gods. Porphyrion was the most powerful of the giants and led the giant army into battle against the Olympians. He was struck down by Heracles and Zeus when, under an evil spell from Zeus, he tried to violate the goddess Hera on the battlefield. But Zeus struck down Porphyrion with his thunderbolt and Heracles killed him with an arrow. In another version, according to Pindar, who calls him the King of the Giants, he was slain by an arrow from the bow of Apollo. Take your choice. Aristophanes' Comedy of the Birds contains two brief Porphyrion mentions in the company of other giants by the Latin poet Horace. Keep reading, look up, look around, and get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.